researchers call this trait the thrifty gene. And while the gene represents a useful adaptation in an environment of food scarcity and unpredictability, it's a disaster in an environment of fast food abundance when the opportunity to feast presents itself 24/7. Our bodies are storing reserves of fat against a famine that never comes. But if evolution has left the modern omnivore vulnerable to the blandishments of supersizing, the particular nutrients he's most likely to encounter in those supersized portions, lots of added sugar and fat, make the problem that much worse. Like most other warm-blooded creatures, humans have inherited a preference for energy-dense foods, a preference reflected in the sweet tooth shared by most mammals. Natural selection predisposed us to the taste of sugar and fat, its texture as well as taste, because sugars and fats offer the most energy, which is what a calorie is per bite. Yet in nature, in whole foods, we seldom encounter these nutrients in the concentrations we now find them in processed foods. You won't find a fruit with anywhere near the amount of fructose in a soda, or a piece of animal flesh with quite as much fat as a chicken nugget. You begin to see why processing foods is such a good strategy for getting people to eat more of it. The power of food science lies in its ability to break foods down into their nutrient parts and then reassemble them in specific ways that, in effect, push our evolutionary buttons, fooling the omnivore's inherited food selection system. Add fat or sugar to anything, and it's going to taste better on the tongue of an animal that natural selection has wired to seek out energy-dense foods. Animal studies prove the point. Rats presented with solutions of pure sucrose or tubs of pure lard, goodies they seldom encounter in nature, will gorge themselves sick. Whatever nutritional wisdom the rats are born with breaks down when faced with sugars and fats in unnatural concentrations. Nutrients ripped from their natural context, which is to say, from those things we call foods. Food systems can cheat by exaggerating their energy density, tricking a sensory apparatus that evolved to deal with markedly less dense whole foods. It is the amped-up energy density of processed foods that gets omnivores like us into trouble. Type 2 diabetes typically occurs when the body's mechanism for managing glucose simply wears out from overuse. Just about everything we eat sooner or later winds up in the blood as molecules of glucose, but sugars and simple starches turn to glucose faster than anything else. Type 2 diabetes and obesity is exactly what you would expect to see in a mammal whose environment has overwhelmed its metabolism with energy-dense foods. This begs the question of why the problem has gotten so much worse recently. It turns out the price of a calorie of sugar or fat has plummeted since the 1970s. One reason that obesity and diabetes become more prevalent the further down the socioeconomic scale you look is that the industrial food chain has made energy-dense foods the cheapest foods in the market, when measured in terms of cost per calorie. A recent study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition compared the energy cost of different foods in the supermarket. The researchers found that a dollar could buy 1,200 calories of potato chips and cookies. Spent on a whole food like carrots, the same dollar buys only 250 calories. On the beverage aisle, you can buy 875 calories of soda for a dollar, or 170 calories of fruit juice from concentrate. It makes good economic sense that people with limited money to spend on food would spend it on the cheapest calories they can find, especially when the cheapest calories, fats and sugars, are precisely the ones offering the biggest neurobiological rewards. Corn is not the only source of cheap energy in the supermarket. Much of the fat added to processed foods comes from soybeans, but it is by far the most important. As George Naylor said, growing corn is the most efficient way to get energy, calories, from an acre of Iowa farmland. That corn-made calorie can find its way into our bodies in the form of an animal fat, a sugar, or a starch. Such is the protean nature of the carbon in that big kernel. But as productive and protean as the corn plant is, finally it is a set of human choices that have made these molecules quite as cheap as they have become. A quarter century of farm policies designed to encourage the overproduction of this crop and hardly any other. Very simply, we subsidize high fructose corn syrup in this country, but not carrots. While the Surgeon General is raising alarms over the epidemic of obesity, the President is signing farm bills designed to keep the river of cheap corn flowing, guaranteeing that the cheapest calories in the supermarket will continue to be the most fattening. Chapter 7. The Meal. Fast Food. The meal at the end of the industrial food chain that begins in an Iowa cornfield is prepared by McDonald's and eaten in a moving car. Or at least this was the version of the industrial meal I chose to eat. It could easily have been another. The myriad streams of commodity corn, after being variously processed and turned into meat, converge in all sorts of different meals I might have eaten, at KFC or Pizza Hut or Applebee's, or prepared myself from ingredients bought at the supermarket. Industrial meals are all around us, after all. They make up the food chain from which most of us eat most of the time. My 11-year-old son Isaac was more than happy to join me at McDonald's. He doesn't get there often, so it's a treat. For most American children today, it is no longer such a treat. 1 in 3 of them eat fast food every single day. Judith, my wife, was less enthusiastic. She's careful about what she eats, and having a fast food lunch meant giving up a real meal, which seemed a shame. Isaac pointed out that she could order one of McDonald's new premium salads with the Paul Newman dressing. I read in the business pages that these salads are a big hit, but even if they weren't, they'd probably stay on the menu strictly for their rhetorical usefulness. The marketers have a term for what a salad or veggie burger does for a fast food chain: denying the denier. These healthier menu items hand the child who wants to eat fast food a sharp tool with which to chip away at his parents' objections. "But Mom, you can get the salad." Which is exactly what Judith did. Order the Cobb salad with Caesar dressing. At $3.99, it was the most expensive item on the menu. I ordered a classic cheeseburger, large fries, and a large Coke. Large turns out to be a full 32 ounces. A quart of soda. But thanks to the magical economics of supersizing, it only cost 30 cents more than the 16-ounce small. Isaac went with the new white meat chicken McNuggets, a double-thick vanilla shake, and a large order of fries, followed by a new dessert treat consisting of freeze-dried pellets of ice cream. That each of us ordered something different is a hallmark of the industrial food chain, which breaks the family down into its various demographics and markets separately to each one. We would be eating alone together, and therefore probably eating more. The total for the three of us came to $14 and was packed up and ready to go in 4 minutes. Before I left the register, I picked up a densely printed handout called "A Full Serving of Nutrition Facts. Choose the best meal for you." We could have slipped into a booth, but it was such a nice day we decided to put the top down on the convertible and eat our lunch in the car, something the food and the car have both been engineered to accommodate. These days, 19% of American meals are eaten in the car. The car has cup holders, front seat and rear, and, except for the salad, all the food, which we could have ordered, paid for, and picked up without opening the car door, can be readily eaten with one hand. Indeed, this is the genius of the chicken nugget. It liberated chicken from the fork and plate, making it as convenient, waste-free, and automobile-friendly as the pre-condimented hamburger. No doubt the food scientists at McDonald's corporate headquarters in Oak Brook, Illinois, are right now hard at work on the one-handed salad. But though Judith's Cobb salad did present a challenge to front-seat dining, eating it at 55 miles per hour seemed like the thing to do, since corn was the theme of this meal. The car was eating corn too, being fueled in part by ethanol. Even though the additive promises to diminish air quality in California, new federal mandates pushed by the corn processors require refineries in the state to help eat the corn surplus by diluting their gasoline with 10% ethanol. I ate a lot of McDonald's as a kid. This was in the pre-Wallerstein era, when you still had to order a second little burger or sack of fries if you wanted more, and the chicken nugget had not yet been invented. One memorable childhood McDonald's meal ended when our station wagon got rear-ended at a light, propelling my milkshake across the car in creamy white lariats. I loved everything about fast food. The individual portions all wrapped up like presents. Not having to share with my three sisters was a big part of the appeal. Fast food was private property at its best. The familiar, meaty perfume of the French fries filling the car, and the pleasingly sequenced bites into a burger. The soft, sweet roll, the crunchy pickle, the savory moistness of the meat. Well-designed fast food has a fragrance and flavor all its own. A fragrance and flavor only nominally connected to hamburgers or French fries, or for that matter, to any particular food. Certainly the hamburgers and fries you make at home don't have it. And yet, Chicken McNuggets do, even though they're ostensibly an entirely different food made from a different species. Whatever it is, surely the food scientists know. For countless millions of people living now, this generic fast food flavor is one of the unerasable smells and tastes of childhood, which makes it a kind of comfort food. Like other comfort foods, it supplies, besides nostalgia, a jolt of carbohydrates and fat, which, some scientists now believe, relieve stress and bathe the brain in chemicals that make it feel good. Isaac announced that his white meat McNuggets were tasty, a definite improvement over the old recipe. McNuggets have come in for a lot of criticism recently, which might explain the reformulation. Ruling in 2003 in a lawsuit brought against McDonald's by a group of obese teenagers, a federal judge in New York had defamed the McNugget even as he dismissed the suit. Rather than being merely chicken fried in a pan, he wrote in his decision, McNuggets are a McFrankensteinian creation of various elements not utilized by the home cook. After cataloging the 38 ingredients in a McNugget, Judge Sweet suggested that McDonald's marketing bordered on deceptive, since the dish is not what it proposed to be. That is, a piece of chicken, simply fried, and, contrary to what a consumer might reasonably expect, actually contains more fat and total calories than a cheeseburger. Since the lawsuit, McDonald's has reformulated the nugget with white meat and begun handing out a full serving of nutrition facts. In 2006, McDonald's began printing nutrition information on its packaging. According to the flyer, a serving of 6 nuggets now has precisely 10 fewer calories than a cheeseburger. Chalk up another achievement for food science. When I asked Isaac if the new nuggets tasted more like chicken than the old ones, he seemed baffled by the question. No, they taste like what they are, which is nuggets. And then dropped on his dad a withering 2-syllable, duh. In this consumer's mind, at least, the link between a nugget and the chicken in it was never more than notional, and probably irrelevant. By now, the nugget constitutes its own genre of food for American children, many of whom eat nuggets every day. For Isaac, the nugget is a distinct taste of childhood, quite apart from chicken, and no doubt a future vehicle of nostalgia, a Madeleine in the making. Isaac passed one up to the front for Judith and I to sample. It looked and smelled pretty good, with a nice crust and bright white interior reminiscent of chicken breast meat. In appearance and texture, a nugget certainly alludes to fried chicken, yet all I could really taste was salt. That all-purpose fast food flavor, and okay, maybe a note of chicken bouillon informing the salt. Overall, the nugget seemed more like an abstraction than a full-fledged food, an idea of chicken waiting to be fleshed out. Certainly, the ingredients listed in the flyer suggest a lot of thought goes into a nugget, that and a lot of corn. Of the 38 ingredients it takes to make a McNugget, I counted 13 that can be derived from corn. The corn-fed chicken itself, modified cornstarch to bind the pulverized chicken meat, mono, tri, and diglycerides, emulsifiers which keep the fats and water from separating, dextrose, lecithin, another emulsifier, chicken broth to restore some of the flavor that processing leaches out, yellow corn flour and more modified cornstarch for the batter, cornstarch, a filler, vegetable shortening, partially hydrogenated corn oil, and citric acid as a preservative. A couple of other plants take part in the nugget. There's some wheat in the batter, and on any given day the hydrogenated oil could come from soybeans, canola, or cotton rather than corn, depending on market price and availability. According to the handout, McNuggets also contain several completely synthetic ingredients, quasi-edible substances that ultimately come not from a corn or soybean field, but from a petroleum refinery or chemical plant. These chemicals are what make modern processed foods possible, by keeping the organic materials in them from going bad or looking strange after months in the freezer or on the road. Listed first are the leavening agents: sodium aluminum phosphate, monocalcium phosphate, sodium acid pyrophosphate, and calcium lactate. These are antioxidants needed to keep the various animal and vegetable fats involved in a nugget from turning rancid. Then there are anti-foaming agents like dimethylpolysiloxane, added to the cooking oil to keep the starches from binding to air molecules so as to produce foam during the fry. The problem is evidently grave enough to warrant adding a toxic chemical to the food. According to the Handbook of Food Additives, dimethylpolysiloxane is a suspected carcinogen and an established mutagen, tumorigen, and reproductive effector. It's also flammable. But perhaps the most alarming ingredient in a chicken McNugget is tertiary butyl hydroquinone, or TBHQ, an antioxidant derived from petroleum that is either sprayed directly on the nugget or the inside of the box it comes in to help preserve freshness. According to a Consumer's Dictionary of Food Additives, TBHQ is a form of butane, that is, lighter fluid, the FDA allows processors to use sparingly in our food. It can comprise no more than 0.02% of the oil in a nugget, which is probably just as well, considering that ingesting a single gram of TBHQ can cause nausea, vomiting, ringing in the ears, delirium, a sense of suffocation, and collapse. Ingesting 5 grams of TBHQ can kill. With so many exotic molecules organized into a food of such complexity, you would almost expect a chicken nugget to do something more than taste okay to a child and fill him up inexpensively. What it has done, of course, is sell an awful lot of chicken for companies like Tyson, which invented the nugget, at McDonald's behest, in 1983. The nugget is the reason chicken has supplanted beef as the most popular meat in America. Compared to Isaac's nuggets, my cheeseburger is a fairly simple construct. According to A Full Serving of Nutrition Facts, the cheeseburger contains a mere 6 ingredients, all but one of them familiar: a 100% beef patty, a bun, 2 American cheese slices, ketchup, mustard, pickles, onions, and grill seasoning, whatever that is. It tasted pretty good, too, though on reflection what I mainly tasted were the condiments. Sampled by itself, the gray patty had hardly any flavor. And yet, the whole package, especially on first bite, did manage to give off a fairly convincing burgerish aura. I suspect, however, that owes more to the olfactory brilliance of the grill seasoning than to the 100% beef patty. In truth, my cheeseburger's relationship to beef seemed nearly as metaphorical as the nugget's relationship to a chicken. Eating it, I had to remind myself that there was an actual cow involved in this meal, most likely a burned-out old dairy cow, the source of most fast-food beef, but possibly bits and pieces of a steer like 534 as well. Part of the appeal of hamburgers and nuggets is that their boneless abstractions allow us to forget we're eating animals. I'd been on the feedlot in Garden City only a few months earlier, yet this experience of cattle was so far removed from that one as to be taking place in a different dimension. No, I could not taste the feed corn and the petroleum or the antibiotics and the hormones, or the feedlot manure. Yet while A Full Serving of Nutrition Facts did not enumerate these facts, they too have gone into the making of this hamburger, are part of its natural history. That perhaps is what the industrial food chain does best: obscure the histories of the foods it produces by processing them to such an extent that they appear as pure products of culture rather than nature, things made from plants and animals. despite the blizzard of information contained in the helpful McDonald's flyer, the thousands of words and numbers specifying ingredients and portion sizes, calories and nutrients, all this food remains perfectly opaque. Where does it come from? It comes from McDonald's. But that's not so. It comes from refrigerated trucks and from warehouses, from slaughterhouses, from factory farms in towns like Garden City, Kansas, from ranches in Sturgis, South Dakota, from food science laboratories in Oak Brook, Illinois, from flavor companies on the New Jersey Turnpike, from petroleum refineries, from processing plants owned by ADM and Cargill, from grain elevators in towns like Jefferson, and, at the end of that long and tortuous trail, from a field of corn and soybeans farmed by George Naylor in Chirton, Iowa. It would not be impossible to calculate exactly how much corn Judith, Isaac, and I consumed in our McDonald's meal. I figure my 4-ounce burger, for instance, represents nearly 2 pounds of corn, based on a cow's feed conversion rate of 7 pounds of corn for every 1 pound of gain, half of which is edible meat. The nuggets are a little harder to translate into corn, since there's no telling how much actual chicken goes into a nugget. But if 6 nuggets contain 1/4 pound of meat, that would have taken a chicken 1/2 pound of feed corn to grow. A 32-ounce soda contains 86 grams of high-fructose corn syrup, as does a double-thick shake, which can be refined from 1/3 pound of corn. So our 3 drinks used another 1 pound. Subtotal? 6 pounds of corn. From here, the calculations become trickier because, according to the ingredients list in the flyer, corn is everywhere in our meal, but in unspecified amounts. There's more corn sweetener in my cheeseburger, of all places. The bun and the ketchup both contain HFCS. It's in the salad dressing, too, and the sauces for the nuggets, not to mention Isaac's dessert. Of the 60 menu items listed in the handout, 45 contain HFCS. Then there are all the other corn ingredients in the nugget, the binders and emulsifiers and fillers. In addition to corn sweeteners, Isaac's shake contains corn syrup solids, mono and diglycerides, and milk from corn-fed animals. Judith's Cobb salad is also stuffed with corn, even though there's not a kernel in it. Paul Newman makes his dressing with HFCS, corn syrup, cornstarch, dextrin, caramel color, and xanthan gum. The salad itself contains cheese and eggs from corn-fed animals. The salad's grilled chicken breast is injected with a flavor solution that contains maltodextrin, dextrose, and monosodium glutamate. Sure, there are a lot of leafy greens in Judith's salad too, but the overwhelming majority of the calories in it, and there are 500 of them when you count the dressing, ultimately come from corn. And the French fries? You would think those are mostly potatoes. Yet since half of the 540 calories in a large order of fries come from the oil they're fried in, the ultimate source of these calories is not a potato farm, but a field of corn or soybeans. The calculation finally defeated me, but I took it far enough to estimate that if you include the corn in the gas tank, a whole bushel right there to make 2.5 gallons of ethanol, the amount of corn that went into producing our movable fast food feast would easily have overflowed the car's trunk, spilling a trail of golden kernels on the blacktop behind us. Sometime later, I found another way to calculate just how much corn we had eaten that day. I asked Todd Dawson, a biologist at Berkeley who regularly uses a mass spectrometer, to run a McDonald's meal through his machine and calculate how much of the carbon in it came originally from a corn plant. It is hard to believe that the identity of the atoms in a cheeseburger or a Coke is preserved from farm field to fast food counter, but the atomic signature of those carbon isotopes is indestructible and still legible to the mass spectrometer. Dawson and his colleague Stefania Mambelli prepared an analysis showing roughly how much of the carbon in the various McDonald's menu items came from corn and plotted them on a graph. The sodas came out at the top, not surprising since they consist of little else but corn sweetener. But virtually everything else we ate revealed a high proportion of corn, too. In order of diminishing corniness, this is how the laboratory measured our meal. Soda, 100%. Milkshake, 78%. Salad dressing, 65%. Chicken nuggets, 56%. Cheeseburger, 52%. And French fries, 23%. What, in the eyes of the omnivore, looks like a meal of impressive variety turns out, when viewed through the eyes of the mass spectrometer, to be the meal of a far more specialized kind of eater. But then, this is what the industrial eater has become. The koala of corn. So what? Why should it matter that we have become a race of corn eaters such as the world has never seen? Is this necessarily a bad thing? The answer all depends on where you stand. If where you stand is in agribusiness, processing cheap corn into 45 different McDonald's items is an impressive accomplishment. It represents a solution to the agricultural contradictions of capitalism, the challenge of increasing food industry profits faster than America can increase its population. Supersized portions of cheap corn-fixed carbon solves the problem of the fixed stomach. We may not be expanding the number of eaters in America, but we've figured out how to expand each of their appetites, which is almost as good. Judith, Isaac, and I together consumed a total of 4,510 calories at our lunch, more than half as many as we each should probably consume in a day. We had certainly done our part in chomping through the corn surplus. We had also consumed a lot of petroleum, and not just because we were in a car. To grow and process those 4,510 food calories took at least 10 times as many calories of fossil energy, the equivalent of 1.3 gallons of oil. If where you stand is on one of the lower rungs of America's economic ladder, our cornified food chain offers real advantages. Not cheap food exactly, for the consumer ultimately pays the added cost of processing, but cheap calories in a variety of attractive forms. In the long run, however, the eater pays a high price for these cheap calories: obesity, type 2 diabetes, heart disease. If where you stand is at the lower end of the world's economic ladder, however, America's corn-fed food chain looks like an unalloyed disaster. I mentioned earlier that all life on Earth can be viewed as a competition for the energy captured by plants and stored in carbohydrates, energy we measure in calories. There is a limit to how many of those calories the world's arable land can produce each year, and an industrial meal of meat and processed food consumes and wastes an unconscionable amount of that energy. To eat corn directly, as Mexicans and many Africans do, is to consume all the energy in that corn. But when you feed that corn to a steer or a chicken, 90% of its energy is lost to bones or feathers or fur, to living and metabolizing as a steer or chicken. This is why vegetarians advocate eating low on the food chain. Every step up the chain reduces the amount of food energy by a factor of 10, which is why in any ecosystem there are only a fraction as many predators as there are prey. But processing food also burns energy. What this means is that the amount of food energy lost in the making of something like a chicken McNugget could feed a great many more children than just mine, and that behind the 4,510 calories the three of us had for lunch stand tens of thousands of corn calories that could have fed a great many hungry people. And how does this corn-fed food chain look if where you stand is in the middle of a field of corn? Well, it depends on whether you are the corn farmer or the plant. For the corn farmer, you might think the cornification of our food system would have redounded to his benefit, but it has not. Corn's triumph is the direct result of its overproduction, and that has been a disaster for the people who grow it. Growing corn, and nothing but corn, has also exacted a toll on the farmer's soil, the quality of the local water, and the overall health of his community, the biodiversity of his landscape, and the health of all the creatures living on or downstream from it. And not only those creatures, for cheap corn has also changed, and much for the worse, the lives of several billion food animals. Animals that would not be living on factory farms if not for the ocean of corn on which these animal cities float. But return to that Iowa farm field for a moment and look at the matter, at us, from the standpoint of the corn plant itself. Corn, 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 as far as the eye can see, 10-foot stalks soldiering in perfect 30-inch rows to the far horizon, an 80-million-acre corn lawn rolling across the continent. It's a good thing this plant can't form an impression of us, for how risible that impression would be. The farmers going broke cultivating it, the countless other species routed or eviscerated by it, the humans eating and drinking it as fast as they can, some of them, like me and my family, in automobiles engineered to drink it too. Of all the species that have figured out how to thrive in a world dominated by Homo sapiens, surely no other has succeeded more spectacularly, has colonized more acres and bodies than Z. maize, the grass that domesticated its domesticator. You have to wonder why we Americans don't worship this plant as fervently as the Aztecs. Like they once did, we make extraordinary sacrifices to it. These, at least, were my somewhat fevered speculations as we sped down the highway, putting away our fast food lunch. What is it about fast food? Not only is it served in a flash, but more often than not, it's eaten that way too. We finished our meal in under 10 minutes. Since we were in the convertible and the sun was shining, I can't blame the McDonald's ambiance. Perhaps the reason you eat this food quickly is because it doesn't bear savoring. The more you concentrate on how it tastes, the less like anything it tastes. I said before that McDonald's serves a kind of comfort food, but after a few bites, I'm more inclined to think they're selling something more schematic than that. Something more like a signifier of comfort food. So you eat more and eat more quickly, hoping somehow to catch up to the original idea of a cheeseburger or French fry as it retreats over the horizon. And so it goes, bite after bite, until you feel not satisfied exactly, but simply, regrettably, full. Part 2. Pastoral Grass. Chapter 8. All flesh is grass. Green Acres. Early in the afternoon on the first day of summer, I found myself sitting in the middle of an impossibly green pasture, resting. The longest day of the year is what I would jot down in my journal in bed late that night, followed by literally, which was then struck out and replaced with figuratively. What can I say? I was tired. I'd spent the afternoon making hay. Really just lending a hand to a farmer making hay, and after a few hours in the midday sun hoisting and throwing 50-pound bales onto a hay wagon, I hurt. We think of grass as soft and hospitable stuff, but once it's been dried in the sun and shredded by machines, once it's become hay, grass is sharp enough to draw blood and dusty enough to thicken lungs. I was covered in chaff, my forearms tattooed red with its pinpricks. The others, Joel Salatin, whose farm this was, his grown son Daniel, and two helpers, had gone off to the barn for something, leaving me with a welcome moment in the pasture to gather myself before we cranked up the baler again. We were racing to get this hay in before thunderstorms predicted for the evening. It was Monday, my first day working on the farm, and thus far my principal conclusion was that in the event I survived the labors of the week, I would never again begrudge a farmer any price he cared to name for his produce. $1 for an egg seemed entirely reasonable. $50 for a steak, a steal. The wail of farm machinery had fallen silent, and in the space it left I could hear the varied sounds of birds. Songbirds in the trees, but also the low gossip of hens and the lower throat singing of turkeys. Up on the green, green shoulder of hill rising to the west, I could see a small herd of cattle grazing, and below them on a gentler slope, several dozen portable chicken pens marching in formation down the meadow. Laid before me was, I realized, a scene of almost classical pastoral beauty. The meadows dotted with contented animals, the backdrop of woods, a twisting brook threading through it all, marred only by the fact that I couldn't just lay here on this springy pasture admiring it for the rest of the afternoon. Wasn't leisure supposed to be a big part of the pastoral idyll? Our culture, perhaps even our biology, is programmed to respond to just such a grassy middle landscape, suspended as it is halfway between the wilderness of forest and the artifice of civilization. The argument of the verdurous vista, Henry James once called it. He had just returned from Europe to tour rural New England and found himself beguiled by Connecticut's pastoral charms in spite of himself and all he knew about history, about the inevitable triumph of the machine, the bullying railway. A century earlier, of course, Thomas Jefferson had made the argument of the verdurous vista with a force some of us still feel. His agrarian ideal was an attempt to make a literal American reality out of the old world's pastoral dreams, though even he sometimes doubted the middle landscape could survive the advent of industry. But then the pastoral idyll was already in trouble even in Virgil's time, threatened by the encroaching marshlands on one side, the corruptions of civilization on the other. The wonder really is that it survives at all. 2 centuries and a 1-hour drive over the Blue Ridge from Monticello, Joel Salatin, a self-described Christian, conservative, libertarian, environmentalist, lunatic farmer, is attempting again and against all odds to put real live grass under the old agrarian pastoral ideal, to try to make it new long after the triumph of the industrial system Jefferson fretted over has been completed. I'd come here to the Shenandoah Valley to see whether such a farm, and the alternative food chain it is part of, belonged to the past or the future. Taking in Salatin's verdurous vista that afternoon, it occurred to me that the only thing missing from the scene was a happy shepherd. But then, wasn't that the tall fellow loping toward me in the broad blue suspenders and the floppy hat? Salatin's broad-brimmed straw hat did more than protect his neck and face from the Virginia sun. It declared a political and aesthetic stance, one descended from Virgil through Jefferson with a detour through the 60s counterculture. Whereas a feed company cap blazoned with the logo of an agribusiness giant would have said labor, would have implied, in more ways than one, a debt to the industrial, Salatin's jaunty chapeau, made of grass, note, rather than plastic, bespoke independence, sufficiency, even ease. "On our farm, the animals do most of the work," he had told me the first time we talked. At the moment, too tired to stand, the claim sounded to me like a pretty empty pastoral conceit. But as I would understand by the end of my week on Salatin's farm, the old pastoral idea is alive and, if not well exactly, still useful, perhaps even necessary. The genius of the place. Polyface Farm raises chicken, beef, turkeys, eggs, rabbits, and pigs, plus tomatoes, sweet corn, and berries on 100 acres of pasture patchworked into another 400 acres of forest. But if you ask Joel Salatin what he does for a living, is he foremost a cattle rancher? A chicken farmer? He'll tell you in no uncertain terms, "I'm a grass farmer." The first time I heard this designation, I didn't get it at all. Hay seemed the least and least edible of his many crops, and he brought none of it to market. But undergirding the farm of many faces, as he calls it, is a single plant, or rather that whole community of plants for which the word grass is shorthand. Grass, so understood, is the foundation of the intricate food chain Salatin has assembled at Polyface, where a half dozen different animal species are raised together in an intensive rotational dance on the theme of symbiosis. Salatin is the choreographer, and the grasses are his verdurous stage. The dance has made Polyface one of the most productive and influential alternative farms in America. Though it was only the third week of June, the pasture beneath me had already seen several rotational turns. Before being cut earlier in the week for the hay that would feed the farm's animals through the winter, it had been grazed twice by beef cattle, which, after each day-long stay, had been succeeded by several hundred laying hens. They'd arrived by Eggmobile, a ramshackle portable hen house designed and built by Saladin. Why chickens? Because that's how it works in nature, Saladin explained. Birds follow and clean up after herbivores. And so, during their turn in the pasture, the hens had performed several ecological services for the cattle as well as the grass. They'd picked the tasty grubs and fly larvae out of the cowpats, in the process spreading the manure and eliminating parasites. This is what Joel has in mind when he says the animals do the work around here. The hens are his sanitation crew, the reason his cattle have no need of chemical parasiticides. And while they were at it, nibbling on the short cattle-clipped grasses they like best, the chickens applied a few thousand pounds of nitrogen to the pasture and produced several thousand uncommonly rich and tasty eggs. After a few weeks' rest, the pasture will be grazed again, each steer turning these lush grasses into beef at the rate of 2 or 3 pounds a day. By the end of the season, Saladin's grasses will have been transformed by his animals into some 40,000 pounds of beef, 30,000 pounds of pork, 10,000 broilers, 1,200 turkeys, 1,000 rabbits, and 35,000 dozen eggs. This is an astounding cornucopia of food to draw from 100 acres of pasture. Yet what is perhaps still more astonishing is the fact that this pasture will be in no way diminished by the process. In fact, it will be the better for it. Lusher, more fertile, even springier underfoot. This thanks to the increased earthworm traffic. Saladin's audacious bet is that feeding ourselves from nature need not be a zero-sum proposition, one in which if there is more for us at the end of the season, then there must be less for nature. Less topsoil, less fertility, less life. He's betting, in other words, on a very different proposition, one that looks an awful lot like the proverbially unattainable free lunch. And none of it happens without the grass. In fact, the first time I met Saladin, he'd insisted that even before I met any of his animals, I get down on my belly in this very pasture to make the acquaintance of the less charismatic species his farm was nurturing, that, in turn, were nurturing his farm. Taking the ant's eye view, he ticked off the census of a single square foot of pasture. Orchard grass, foxtail, a couple of different fescues, bluegrass, and timothy. Then he cataloged the legumes. Red clover and white, plus lupins. And finally, the forbs, broad-leaved species like plantain, dandelion, and Queen Anne's lace. And those were just the plants, the species occupying the surface along with a handful of itinerant insects. Below decks and out of sight tunneled earthworms, knowable by their castled mounds of rich castings. Pocket gophers, woodchucks, and burrowing insects, all making their dim way through an unseen wilderness of bacteria, phages, eelish nematodes, shrimpy rotifers, and miles upon miles of mycelium, the underground filaments of fungi. We think of the grasses as the basis of this food chain, yet behind or beneath the grassland stands the soil, that inconceivably complex community of the living and the dead. Because a healthy soil digests the dead to nourish the living, Saladin calls it the earth's stomach. But it is upon the grass, mediator of soil and sun, that the human gaze has always tended to settle, and not just our gaze either. A great many animals, too, are drawn to grass, which partly accounts for our own deep attraction to it. We come here to eat the animals that ate the grass that we, lacking rumens, can't eat ourselves. All flesh is grass. The Old Testament's earthy equation reflects a pastoral culture's appreciation of the food chain that sustained it, though the hunter-gatherers living on the African savanna thousands of years earlier would have understood the flesh-grass connection just as well. It's only in our own time, after we began raising our food animals on grain in confined animal feeding operations, following the dubious new equation, all flesh is corn, that our ancient engagement with grass could be overlooked. Or should I say partly overlooked? For surely our abiding affection for the stuff, reflected in our scrupulously tended lawns and playing fields, as well as in the persistence of so many forms of grassy pastoral, in everything from poetry to supermarket labels, expresses an unconscious recognition of our one-time dependence. Our inclination toward grass, which has the force of a tropism, is frequently cited as a prime example of biophilia, E.O. Wilson's term for what he claims is our inherited genetic attraction for the plants and animals and landscapes with which we evolved. Certainly, I was feeling the pull of the pastoral that summer afternoon on Joel Salatin's farm. Whether or not its wellsprings were in my genes, who can really say, but the idea does not strike me as implausible in the least. Our species' co-evolutionary alliance with the grasses has deep roots and has probably done more to ensure our success as a species than any other, with the possible exception of our alliance with the trillion or so bacteria that inhabit the human gut. Working together, grass and man have overspread much of the earth, far more of each than would ever have been possible working alone. This human-grass alliance has, in fact, had two distinct phases, taking us all the way from our time as hunter-gatherers to agriculturists, or, to date this natural history as the grasses might, from the age of perennials, like the fescues and bluegrass in these pastures, to the age of annuals, such as the corn George Naylor and I had planted in Iowa. In the first phase, which began when our earliest ancestors came down out of the trees to hunt animals on the savannah, the human relationship with grass was mediated by animals that, unlike us, could digest it, in much the same way it still is on Joel Salatin's postmodern savannah. Like Salatin, hunter-gatherers deliberately promoted the welfare of the grasses in order to attract and fatten the animals they depended upon. Hunters would set fire to the savanna to keep it free of trees and nourish the soil. In a sense, they too were grass farmers, deliberately nurturing grasses so that they might harvest meat. So at least it appeared to us. Regarded from the grasses' point of view, the arrangement appears even cleverer. The existential challenge facing grasses in all but the most arid regions is how to successfully compete against trees for territory and sunlight. The evolutionary strategy they hit upon was to make their leaves nourishing and tasty to animals, who in turn are nourishing and tasty to us, the big-brained creature best equipped to vanquish the trees on their behalf. But for this strategy to succeed, the grasses needed an anatomy that could withstand the rigors of both grazing and fire. So they developed a deep root system and a ground-hugging crown that in many cases puts out runners, allowing the grass to recover quickly from fire and to reproduce even when grazers, or lawnmowers, prevent them from ever flowering and going to seed. I used to think we were dominating the grass whenever we mowed the lawn, but in fact we're playing right into their strategy for world domination by helping them outcompete the shrubs and trees.
End of Disc 4.
The second phase of the marriage of grasses and humans is usually called the invention of agriculture, a self-congratulatory phrase that overlooks the role of the grasses themselves in revising the terms of the relationship. Beginning about 10,000 years ago, a handful of particularly opportunistic grass species, the ancestors of wheat, rice, and corn, evolved to produce tremendous, nutritionally dense seeds that could nourish humans directly, thereby cutting out the intermediary animals. The grasses accomplished this feat by becoming annuals, throwing all their energy into making seeds rather than storing some of it underground in roots and rhizomes to get through the winter. These monster annual grasses outcompeted not only the trees, which humans obligingly cut down to expand the annuals' habitats, but bested as well the perennial grasses, which in most places succumbed to the plow. Their human sponsors ripped up the great perennial polyculture grasslands to make the earth safe for annuals, which would henceforth be grown in monocultures. Industrial Organic. Hard to believe, but Joel Salatin and George Naylor are, if regarded from a great enough distance, engaged in much the same pursuit, growing grasses to feed the cattle, chickens, and pigs that feed us. Compared to Salatin, however, Naylor participates in an infinitely more complex industrial system, involving not only corn and soybeans, but fossil fuels, petrochemicals, heavy machinery, CAFOs, and an elaborate international system of distribution to move all these elements around. The energy from the Persian Gulf, the corn to the CAFOs, the animals to slaughter, and their meat, finally, to a Walmart or McDonald's near you. Considered as a whole, this system comprises a great machine, transforming inputs of seed and fossil energy into outputs of carbohydrate and protein. And, as with any machine, this one generates streams of waste. The nitrogen and pesticides running off the cornfields, the manure pooling in the feedlot lagoons, the heat and exhaust produced by all the machines within the machine, the tractors and trucks and combines. Polyface Farm stands about as far from this industrialized sort of agriculture as it is possible to get without leaving the planet. Joel's farm exists as a kind of alternative reality to George's. Every term governing a conventional 500-acre corn and bean operation in Chirton, Iowa, finds its mirror opposite here on these 550 acres in Swope, Virginia. To wit, Naylor Farm, industrial. Polyface Farm, pastoral. Annual species, perennial species. Monoculture, polyculture. Fossil energy, solar energy. Global market, local market. Specialized, diversified. Mechanical, biological. Imported fertility, local fertility. Myriad inputs, chicken feed. For half a century now, which is to say for as long as industrial agriculture has held sway in America, the principal alternative to its methods and general approach has gone by the name organic, a word chosen by J.I. Rodale, the founding editor of Organic Gardening and Farming magazine, to imply that nature, rather than the machine, should supply the proper model for agriculture. Before my journey through the organic food industry, I would have thought that virtually any organic farm would belong on the polyface side of this ledger. But it turns out that this is not necessarily the case. There are now industrial organic farms that belong firmly on the left-hand side. Then there is this further paradox. Polyface Farm is technically not an organic farm, though by any standard it is more sustainable than virtually any organic farm. Its example forces you to think a lot harder about what these words, sustainable, organic, natural, really mean. As it happened, the reason I found my way to Polyface Farm in the first place had everything to do with Joel Salatin's unusually strict construction of the word sustainable. As part of my research into the organic food chain, I kept hearing about this organic farmer in Virginia who had no use for the federal government's new organic standards. I also kept hearing about the exceptional food he was producing. So I gave him a call, hoping to get some salty quotes about the organic industry and perhaps get him to ship me a pastured chicken or steak. The salty quotes I got. Speaking in a rapid-fire delivery that sounded like a cross between Bill Clinton and a hopped-up TV evangelist, Salatin delivered a scathing indictment of the organic empire. I struggled to keep up with a spirited diatribe that bounced from the Western conquistador mentality and the clash of paradigms to the innate distinctive desires of a chicken and the impossibility of taking a decidedly Eastern, connected, holistic product and selling it through a decidedly Western, disconnected, reductionist, Wall Streetified marketing system. You know what the best kind of organic certification would be? Make an unannounced visit to a farm and take a good long look at the farmer's bookshelf. Because what you're feeding your emotions and thoughts is what this is really all about. The way I produce a chicken is an extension of my worldview. You can learn more about that by seeing what's sitting on my bookshelf than having me fill out a whole bunch of forms. I asked him what was on his bookshelf. J.I. Rodale, Sir Albert Howard, Aldo Leopold, Wes Jackson, Wendell Berry, Lewis Bromfield. The classic texts of organic agriculture and American agrarianism. We never called ourselves organic. We call ourselves beyond organic. Why dumb down to a lesser level than we are? If I said I was organic, people would fuss at me for getting feed corn from a neighbor who might be using atrazine. Well, I would much rather use my money to keep my neighborhood productive and healthy than export my dollars 500 miles away to get pure product that's really coated in diesel fuel. There are a whole lot more variables in making the right decision than does the chicken feed have chemicals or not. Like, what sort of habitat is going to allow that chicken to express its physiological distinctiveness? A 10,000-bird shed that stinks to high heaven, or a new paddock of fresh green grass every day? Now, which chicken shall we call organic? I'm afraid you'll have to ask the government, because now they own the word. Me and the folks who buy my food are like the Indians. We just want to opt out. That's all the Indians ever wanted, to keep their teepees, to give their kids herbs instead of patent medicines and leeches. They didn't care if there was a Washington, D.C., or a Custer, or a USDA. Just leave us alone. But the Western mind can't bear an opt-out option. We're going to have to refight the battle of the Little Bighorn to preserve the right to opt out, or your grandchildren and mine will have no choice but to eat amalgamated, irradiated, genetically prostituted, barcoded, adulterated fecal spam from the centralized processing conglomerate. Phew. As I indicated earlier, I got my quotes, but in the end I didn't get my food. Before we got off the phone, I asked Salatin if he could ship me one of his chickens and maybe a steak too. He said that he couldn't do that. I figured he meant he wasn't set up for shipping, so offered him my FedEx account number. No, I don't think you understand. I don't believe it's sustainable, or organic, if you will, to FedEx meat all around the country. I'm sorry, but I can't do it. This man was serious. Just because we can ship organic lettuce from the Salinas Valley, or organic cut flowers from Peru, doesn't mean we should do it. Not if we're really serious about energy and seasonality and bioregionalism. I'm afraid if you want to try one of our chickens, you're going to have to drive down here to Swope to pick it up. Which is eventually what I did. But before I traveled to Virginia for my week on the farm, your Paris Hilton adventure, as my wife called it, I spent several weeks touring the organic empire to see if Salatin's criticisms, which had taken me by surprise, were just. A new, alternative food chain was taking shape in this country, and this seemed to me an unalloyed good. What had been a fringe movement in the 1960s was now a thriving business. The fastest-growing corner of the food industry, in fact. Salatin was suggesting that the organic food chain couldn't expand into America's supermarkets and fast food outlets without sacrificing its ideals. I wondered if this wasn't a case of making the ideal an enemy of the good, but Salatin was convinced that industrial organic was finally a contradiction in terms. I decided I had to find out if he was right. Chapter 9. Big Organic. Supermarket Pastoral. I enjoy shopping at Whole Foods nearly as much as I enjoy browsing a good bookstore, which, come to think of it, is probably no accident. Shopping at Whole Foods is a literary experience, too. That's not to take anything away from the food, which is generally of high quality, much of it certified organic or humanely raised or free range. But right there, that's the point. It's the evocative prose as much as anything else that makes this food really special. Elevating an egg or chicken breast or bag of arugula from the realm of ordinary protein and carbohydrates into a much headier experience, one with complex aesthetic, emotional, and even political dimensions. Take the range-fed sirloin steak I recently eyed in the meat case. According to the brochure on the counter, it was formerly part of a steer that spent its days living in beautiful places, ranging from plant-diverse, high mountain meadows to thick aspen groves and miles of sagebrush-filled flats. Now, a steak like that has got to taste better than one from Safeway, where the only accompanying information comes in the form of a number. The price, I mean, which you can bet will be considerably less. but I'm evidently not the only shopper willing to pay more for a good story. With the growth of organics and mounting concerns about the wholesomeness of industrial food, storied food is showing up in supermarkets everywhere these days. But it is Whole Foods that consistently offers the most cutting-edge grocery lit.